Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Lizzie Burden's with us as well. Full house today in the family. I wonder, you political experts, what's our collective noun for prime ministers?
There are a lot of them around these days.
Indeed, yeah. Well, that's what we think is. Yeah. Well, if you include the exes,
a raft, a swarm.
I've just had a cacophony. A cacophony of prime ministers.
A cacophony of PMs.
Is what we had yesterday when we saw, of course, that Brexit vote being passed through Parliament. 515 votes to 22. I mean, it made, to be honest, I know that we're talking a lot about the other prime ministers involved. Boris Johnson and Liz Truss obviously voted against win for Rishi Sunak. I felt a bit sorry for Theresa May, to be honest. Remember the times that we'd be sitting there counting whether or not there'd be 5 votes in it, 10 votes in it, and oof, it was 90, and you think, well, this just feels like a lifetime ago now that something on Brexit can pass so easily through Parliament.
Yes, but hang on a second. I thought that we were going to get a bit of difficulty in actually getting this Northern Ireland issue through Parliament. So I think it's quite a shock that it went through so quickly with such a large vote.
Yeah, just 22 votes. And in fact, 10% of those were disgruntled former prime ministers. Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, almost 10%.
Love that maths calculation.
I like to crunch the numbers. But what incredible symbolism yesterday. I thought it was so powerful.
Absolute scenes. Was that about to happen?
Absolute scenes. Boris Johnson in a stuffy little committee room being grilled by non-entity, backbench MPs he'd never heard of. Let's be a little bit more polite. Being grilled by random backbench MPs who I bet he didn't know the names of before he walked in that room.
Well, the mother of the house as well.
Oh, yes. Harriet Harman is a name, but many of the other ones are pretty random. It was their moment to shine. He was there for half an afternoon being interrogated, whilst at the very same time, Rishi Sunak was triumphant in Parliament, winning, as you say, 515 votes to 22, getting his Brexit deal through against all the odds. I just thought it was such a powerful kind of changing of the guard.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think the other major surprise, I think, politically yesterday was that Rishi Sunak actually revealed the tax returns that he has promised to deliver within a year. He did that. And so there were two ways of looking at this. I think a lot of people thought that it kind of passed without issue. I think the numbers are pretty flabbergasting and that they will end up getting more attention. But on the other hand, there wasn't that much detail to it in the sense that, yes, he received, 600,000 in investment income, £3.8 million in capital gains income between 2019 and 2022. But we don't know much more than that. Mm. He paid £500,000 in taxes in 1 year alone. So I think if voters might sort of think about that. But on the other hand, we all knew that the Prime Minister was very wealthy, married to somebody who's very, very, very wealthy. And so actually, even getting the tax returns out there doesn't seem to have dented him.
I mean, I think it's interesting that we know now that he is a millionaire. We certainly knew that his wife was worth, 800 million or some enormous sum. But we also know that he is wealthy in his own right, which is interesting. So I wonder if Labour campaign literature is going to say millionaire Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, because now we can say that for certain.
Yes.
The other thing interesting, or maybe it's not surprising, is it's the oldest PR trick, isn't it, in the book? pick a day to put out some bad news, and they picked a very good day to put out bad news today.
Yeah, I mean, our intrepid producer, James, got in touch with John Stepek, who, of course, writes the Money to Steal column for Bloomberg, and his take is that essentially these were very boring tax returns.
Yeah, and that's why I sort of countered that point. I don't think they were as boring as they look. I think they, I think perhaps they have cut through. Anyway, we also, though, have got Lizzie Burden with us this morning, who was watching in full Boris Johnson's evidence. we always do like to have a little rant, don't we, on the programme. Lizzie Burden, I think that Boris Johnson looked cornered. I think he looked defensive yesterday. Martin Ivins writes for Bloomberg today that this really is the kind of end of the road for Johnson. He says that the smart money is on Johnson getting off with a grovelling apology and a penalty of less than 10 days, i.e. not putting in jeopardy his seat as an MP, but basically Martin Ivins saying that Johnson has finally lost his political touch. I think I might agree with that.
Yeah, look, who am I to disagree with the great Martin Ivins? I've just parachuted in for one of you in small rants before I glue myself to the BOE decision. But I agree, yesterday was a great day for Rishi Sunak, even if it started with that upside inflation surprise. Economists still reckon that inflation's going to fall later this year. He won that vote, as you say, on the Windsor framework convincingly, despite Liz Truss and Boris Johnson joining the Rebels. And he could sip his Coke smugly with the Partygate testimony dominating the airways. But... right, I've come in here to confess. I could not switch it off yesterday. I know none of you agree with me, but I don't think that the population at large is as bothered as the media make out about Partygate. I think, like Brexit, the Westminster bubble just isn't reading the room here. I agree with Johnson's narrative that he was forced out because of fury whipped up by the media and thrusty MPs. But what the country could have done with was for Johnson to be as serious as he was yesterday when he was in office. He'd had a haircut, he'd got his suit on, his pages were clearly carefully numbered. This was a man who meant business. Where was that when he was on the world stage?
Yeah, but all well and good when the action is passed, you know, that's I disagree. I think that Partygate does cut through to the British public. I think there was a very, very hard time during the pandemic, and I think that that idea of parting in 10 Downing Street, you know, did read across to voters. But hey, that's just my view.
Yeah, I think I'd probably take a view sort of somewhere between the two of you. But there is no doubt that what you said earlier, Caroline, is true, is that his star is, what's the phrase? His star is...
waning, fading?
His star is fading. There's no doubt about the parliamentary arithmetic. Nobody was prepared to back him. He marched into the division lobbies to say, no, I'm not backing this deal. All the ERG, or a lot of the ERG, said, we'll take it. And Boris Johnson was just left looking sort of friendless.
Do you think we'll pay as much attention to the rest of this, Lizzie?
I will.
Be glued to every word.
Well, he's just so charismatic, and ultimately, isn't that what matters with the voters? It's always been priced in that Boris Johnson is like this. We've always known this. Mm. He's great telly.
Yes, but then perhaps there is a moment, I mean... again, it's not an exact comparison, but with Donald Trump, you know, that charisma, sometimes there's a moment when it passes.
Yeah, I mean, he is great telly, there's no doubting that, but I think there's a feeling, certainly in the Conservative Party, that they want somebody who can run things competently. And, you know, charm and charisma and great telly is fine, but we've had all that for quite a few years. Yeah. And I think certain elements of the Conservative Party would like to move on from that.
And Sunak, isn't he running things well? You have to take your hat off to him. He's having victory after victory, ticking off his checklist. Yes, that inflation print didn't look nice, but economists still say it's coming down.
Okay, Lizzie Burden, thank you so much for spending a bit of time with us in the studio, our UK correspondent. And we will, of course, have you back hopefully tomorrow to digest the Bank of England amidst the cost of living crisis. Do they raise interest rates in the UK or not? That'll be quite important politically too.
Well, let's switch gears now and dig into a fascinating piece of Bloomberg research around the UK's power market. Now, our reporters have found that some of the UK's biggest energy companies have been switching on and switching off power plants at peak times in order to secure higher prices.
Now, it's a practice that's earned them some £525 million over a four-year period, a cost ultimately paid by households and businesses. Our power, gas and renewables reporter Todd Gillespie joins us now in studio for more. Todd, great to have you with us. Can you explain exactly how this works? What is the practice that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a complicated one, but basically it revolves around the way that people can operate a power station. So, you know, it's not as simple for the grid operator and for suppliers and generators to just switch stuff on and off at any time they want to. And basically, it takes about 6 hours for a gas-fired power plant to cool down once it's run, which means that if it turns off in an afternoon, it normally won't be available during the peak demand period, which is in the early evening, normally around 5 or 6 p.m. And traders can kind of take advantage of that on high demand days when, like, wind is low, when a lot of there's not much renewable generation in the system and the grid needs to pay these plants to stay on using our money, usually with a premium to fill this shortfall. And when the grid is strained and has few other choices of plants to call on, traders can essentially end up naming their price to be kept on, otherwise they'll switch off.
Okay, so this sounds a bit like gaming the system somehow. Why are they allowed to do this, to decide when they switch on the power and off the power?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, you can basically say that, you know, plants are able to be run according to the commercial interests of people who run them, right? There should be a profit incentive in the market. There should be competition among different providers, which helps drive the cost down. The issue is, on tight days, there isn't much competition at all. There's a supply shortage. There are only a limited number of people who can provide the power that the grid really needs. For instance, when wind is really low, there aren't turbines spinning. There are only a few plants that can just turn up their energy at will. So on days like that, you have outsized market power when you're a trader that runs these kinds of plants.
Talk to us about the money involved with this. I see in your piece you said that they could charge as much as £6,000 a megawatt hour. Is that 60p a kilowatt? That's quite a lot, isn't it? That's expensive. Just talk us through how much money they'd be making potentially from all of this.
Yeah, so I mean, just for context, like a normal megawatt hour before the energy crisis, you're normally talking about £60 per megawatt hour. So this is about about 100 times higher. But that's for like a normal day, you know, like an average sort of hedged price when people will sell their generation in advance. Obviously, during the day, when people can trade at different times, you can trade a year in advance, you can sell out months in advance, you can sell out even as close as half an hour in advance. So there are lots of different ways that traders can basically sell out the generation or pledge their generation to the system. Mm. And that means that when stuff gets super tight, you can end up with a system where the wholesale price during the day is pretty high already. I mean, you could be talking on days, you know, hitting £1,000, maybe £1,500 per megawatt hour. And that, for some traders, they argue, it justifies them hiking it even more when this balancing system, it's called, when the grid needs to top up the supply that it needs. Mm-hmm. It kind of justifies them charging an even higher price because of a scarcity argument.
Ultimately, who pays for all this?
All of us pay for it. So the way that the grid balances the system is they basically have a pot of cash that is essentially bottomless, and they claim it back through charges that are spread across everybody's bills. So if you use the energy system in this country and you pay a bill, this kind of stuff is feeding through to your bills.
Yeah, and I love the fact that Bloomberg actually gets into the weeds of this and it's a really difficult thing to investigate, but it involves some of the names that householders will know. I mean, SSE, for example, Uniper, Vitol. So you must have put all of this to them. What was their response?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer that we got from all of these companies is that they aren't breaking the rules. And it's true. The regulator hasn't found any conclusive evidence of rule breaking. But what you will find now is that the regulator, which is for the first time in our story called this practice manipulation, they are coming out now and trying to change the rules to make it explicitly not allowed.
And is this something that only goes on in the UK? Presumably, the energy markets are right across the continent, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's symptomatic of a market where there is tight supply. So in the UK in particular, in the past few years, there have been a couple of gas plants which have shut off, which haven't been profitable, and therefore the supply is constrained. Electrification at the same time has increased demand. So we're seeing a lower supply and higher demand in terms of, when we're talking about supply, particularly flexible, dispatchable supply, i.e. supply that can come on at will. We're not talking about renewables, which means that when renewables off the system, there's an even smaller proportion of stable generation that can just hop in and fill that gap. So other markets that are experiencing this can sort of see these kind of tight spots as well. We haven't managed yet to delve into the, you know, a lot of other markets yet. The thing about power markets is they're super specific depending on different countries. They're run really differently. It's not like a power trader can just hop from one country to another really easily. There are a whole new set of rules, whole new set of regulations and context for that. But we are definitely keen to look into more countries. So if any listeners have any suggestions, please feel free to email us on the link in our story online.
Yeah, and you can see Todd's big take story story on the terminal or on the Bloomberg UK website. I wonder if I could just inject a note of positivity here. These figures are really quite stark, but we had lots of warnings, didn't we, before the winter started, that the lights were going to go off, it was going to be a disaster, there'd be blackouts everywhere. And actually the system has worked, hasn't it? We've pretty much had winter and the lights stayed on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the traders who generate who use these plants, who run these plants, will say that it's thanks to them that the lights have stayed on. And indeed they have stayed on, but the question is really whether the lights should have stayed on at this cost and in this way, and down to a market where just a few people have an outsized level of power to control it.
So interesting. Thank you so much for being with us, Todd, and for explaining this story. That is our power, gas and renewables reporter, Todd Gillespie. He's written this story along with Gavin Finch and Jason Grotto. So yes, it's on the Bloomberg UK website if you want to read about it.
Well, from power plants then to the high street. Now, polling has consistently shown the cost of living crisis among the biggest concern for voters. Rising prices and costs, of course, part of that picture as well. So an interesting time to think about the state of the UK high street.
Well, Frasers, which owns the UK's biggest sportswear retailer, Sports Direct, is betting on physical stores. It's just opened a third flagship store in Manchester. Well, we've been speaking to CEO Michael Murray about their strategy for the future.
I think that's purely down to our strategy and the execution and the conviction behind the strategy. I think they've got a very proven track record now over the last 2 to 3 years coming out of the pandemic. And we're just staying very laser focused on delivering our strategy. I mean, you've seen obviously the trend over the last 5 years was digital, digital, digital. And we believe it's digital and high street and retail, which is the perfect combination for the future. The cost of acquisition online now is so expensive to acquire new customers. We'd rather invest in the high street and let our consumers come and touch our store environment, see our product, and it also drives online sales together. So we really believe in this omnichannel mix is the future of retail.
What kind of behaviour are you seeing right now from shoppers, given that inflation is weighing on consumers in the UK and that inflation hasn't peaked in Britain?
Yeah, well, it's inflation is obviously dictated by our brand partners. When the prices increase, we follow suit. And obviously, there's been the freight increases, there's the currency headwinds, and unfortunately, there has been inflation, and there will continue to be inflation across all of our price increases across all of our businesses. But what we do offer is choice for our consumers. We don't just sell the highest price point product. People can trade up or down depending on their financial circumstances. And that's, we are very, very conscious of that, making sure we offer choice for each individual consumer who we're targeting.
How much more do you have to expect to raise prices this year?
It's a very, very difficult question. And as I said, we're led by the third party brands. They set the price, recommended prices, and we have to follow. We hope not much, but we will wait and see.
Do you feel you have pricing power left with your customers, though? Are you worried about losing people if the prices continue to go up?
Well, we do have our own brand proposition as well, especially in the sports segment, which we've got a bit more control over. So we will keep an eye on that as well to make sure we can still offer that value to that customer who requires it.
So that was Michael Murray, the CEO of Frasers, who was speaking to Stephen and I about their Sports Direct store in Manchester. I mean, I think it's a really fascinating business in the UK. It's one that surely is poised to pick up any further distressed businesses from the UK high street.
And he said in that interview that, you know, they would be looking to see what options are available. No names in mind, though, when we talk to him about it. Well, let's bring in our own queen of the high street, as I've just dubbed her. Andrea Felstead, Bloomberg Opinion columnist, is with us in studio. Sorry, Andrea, I could have sprung that one on you. Very nice to have you with us. So that was the Fraser CEO we were just hearing from there, talking about wanting to get people into their stores. They're expanding their footprint to do so. Are they alone in wanting to do that in the UK retail space?
No. No, we're seeing lots of retailers go back to the high street. We saw during the pandemic that everybody shopped online. Since things have reopened and consumers feel more comfortable about getting out and about into brick and mortar stores, they really have. They want to feel the fabric. They want to try on the lipstick. They're really enjoying going back to physical stores again. Now, the big question is that going to last? Because just as online over-indexed in the pandemic, probably right now physical stores are over-indexing in everyday shopping. The question is that going to come back to more of an equilibrium? And so the stores that retailers are opening, are they going to find that they're perhaps not as busy, not as productive as they imagined?
And also Frasers were talking, yes, about expanding physical shops, but it was very much about omni-channels. Go and have a look at the fabric, have the experience, but then you shop and have it delivered to your home. And also, I thought John Lewis was turning all of their shops into flats.
Well, exactly. You really need both. That is the message that's coming over, because we don't know where this is going to settle down. So, you know, if you were completely bricks and mortar like Primark, you struggled when we locked down. If you're completely online, ASOS, Boohoo, they have struggled since everybody's going back to stores. So the ideal mix is stores and online. And Next, probably Britain's most successful retailer, has always had a very good mix. Marks and Spencer's have had a good mix, and even John Lewis has had a good mix of stores and online. The trouble is John Lewis is struggling on many fronts, so that's probably not living up to its full potential right now.
I do want to dig into that a little bit, because you wrote a great piece about John Lewis recently and the challenges they're facing. What is going wrong at John Lewis?
Well, they did close many stores, so I think that was very short-sighted. That there's lots of competition, not just online. You've got Dunelm, which is a value home retailer. At Waitrose, you know, Marks and Spencer's has got its act together in food. And actually, Marks and Spencer's is turning round a bit on non-food as well, but it's really got its act together on food. There is a lot of competition. And John Lewis, it has cut stores. It has cut costs in terms of staff. And so, you know, customers were happy to go there when you sort of really felt you were getting good value for money. That doesn't always equal the lowest price and good service. And amid, you know, everything that's happened, that they're not quite feeling like that now. They also had this pledge never to be beaten on price. They got rid of that, and they haven't really replaced it with anything very compelling. So they are struggling on many fronts, and they need to ditch this flats idea. They need to ditch expansion in financial services, and they really need to get, you know, stick to their knitting and get back to being good retailers. We're not talking about the haberdashery department, although it is my favourite.
Mine too.
They really need to get back to basics, be a better retailer. And that will, you know, hopefully bring about a change in their fortunes.
Andrew, you paint a rosy picture of the high street, everybody rushing back after the pandemic, desperate to get into the shops. But if you go to a lot of smaller towns, and I think this is less the case in London, but you go to a lot of smaller towns and they feel pretty run down, don't they? There are lots of vacant shops. So retailers expanding, that's not the norm, is it? There is still trouble out there, broadly.
There are trouble out there, but actually the vacancies have gone down. The empty shops have gone down. Mm. And you know, we often sort of look at high streets, but the out-of-town retail parks are very vibrant at the moment.
Okay.
Which is a problem. How do you regenerate these older high streets? But when you go to, you know, malls and to out-of-town shopping centres, they are very busy.
Is this still as politically potent as it was when I think back to 2011 and Mary Portas, do you remember that, brought in to advise the government then on the future of the British high street, and it was about jobs and economic growth? Is it still a potent issue in that way, retail?
I think it is. I think it is, because, you know, you can see it. You've only got to sort of walk down the high street and you can see the, you know, the boarded up shops. Mm. And it does feel, in some places, not all, it does feel a bit desolate. So yes, I think it is. But it's important to realise how things have shifted, and that, you know, perhaps the high street isn't what we see on the high street, isn't perhaps the full picture of retail.
Fascinating stuff. Bloomberg opinion columnist Andrea Felter, thanks so much for joining us on the show today. I think it's fascinating to read what this means for politics, though, isn't it? Because people see the high street as representative of their community. So they go into town and it looks bombed out. And to them, it feels to them like the economy is struggling, whereas it may just be retail that's struggling.
Is this, to quote one of Andrea's colleagues, Therese Raphael, a vibe session? Is it that things actually are okay, but they feel worse?
Well, yeah. But hang on. I mean, I'm in London, okay? And London is basically a collection of villages. And the little village around me, or the little high streets all dotted around me, they actually are really vibrant. Yes, Oxford Street may be boarded up, but the little high streets around me have got new shops, they've got new restaurants, and, you know, they actually sprung to life after the pandemic.
And will they add to the bigger growth picture that the Prime Minister is trying to achieve with the economy? Will they create as many jobs? Will they pay people as well? You know, there's a kind of a bigger macro question around that shift as well, if people are moving to smaller shops.
Yeah, and there's an interesting pandemic story, isn't it? Is that shifting to neighbourhoods from the big high street? Yeah,
absolutely. Fascinating. That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock. Our audio engineer was Marifal Hussain. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.